It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk to an editor at Discover Magazine about some of the coolest science stories of the month, including a new way archaeologists are discovering lost cities.
First, can Wisconsin become the Napa Valley of craft brewing? Representative Gary Tauchin of Bonduelle says that's his goal in trying to create the Wisconsin Beer Commission.
Wisconsin ranks 11th in the country for the number of breweries per capita, and in addition to researching and promoting these breweries, the commission would focus on trying to promote beer tourism, something like the wine tours of California.
Here with us to share her thoughts on the state of Wisconsin craft brewing and where it might be heading is Deborah Carey. She's the founder and president of New Glarus Brewing Company. New Glarus Brewery has twice been named one of the world's 10 best breweries at the World Brewery Championship. Deb, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Well, what do you think about this prospect of creating a Wisconsin Beer Commission?
Well, I think it's an exciting idea. Wisconsin craft brewers, while we get a lot of play, probably more than our fair share of press coverage from people like yourself, we're still only 5% of all the beer sold in the state of Wisconsin, which I think is a little bit shocking because I've been running this brewery for almost, well, a little more, I guess, now than 20 years. And when I came here, it was craft beer is about 2.5% of all beer consumed in the state. And in 20 years, we've worked our way all the way up to 5%. So we still have a lot of room to grow. And I'm just really proud of the craft brewers of Wisconsin. When you look at awards, you know, where people are competing for beer quality, we always come out with many, many awards. I think there's 60 or 70 small brewers now in the state, if you count all the little brew pubs. And we are really good for tourism because not only are we an agricultural manufacturers, but we also get a lot of visitors from out of state. I know just in my own brewery, we see about 200,000 people a year coming through here. And, you know, I'm not alone. Sprecher, Capital, Point, everybody sees a lot of people coming through looking at not just breweries, but stopping for lunch and checking out the cheese makers and chocolate makers and all the other things there are to do in this wonderful state.
So let's say that Representative Tauchin is successful and there is a creation of a Wisconsin Beer Commission. What kind of difference do you think it'll make in the way that Wisconsin beer is perceived in Wisconsin and around the country?
Well, you know, the road to success is paved with many little pitfalls. And one of the things that craft brewers have been running into is less than supportive legislation. We all sell our beer under the thing called the three-tier system, which I very much support, and I value my wholesale and retail partners. However, over the last 15 years, there has been a concentrated effort to kind of tip favoritism toward the other tiers and away from small brewers. So we've lost some real things of value. And I think that by having a beer commission, there's a possibility that there'll be a group of legislators that will, you know, take the reins and pay attention to our job creation and also, you know, a way to help market ourselves in a along with the State Department of Tourism, you know, to be a little more at the forefront. You know, people sometimes are not aware that while we are this very small percentage of beer sold, the 5%, but we're 50% of all jobs created. And craft brewers, you know, all of these, you know, 60 or 70 people, I forget exactly the number, that are in production currently, our cost of construction for our bricks and mortar is upwards of $2,000 a square foot. So we are really the backbone and really investing hard in our state.
Do you think it's feasible that Wisconsin could become a beer destination, you know, along the lines of Napa Valley and the way they are to wine? Is that a possibility?
Well, I think that a lot of people are surprised that we're not. I talk to people all the time that are very shocked that Wisconsin is kind of middle of the pack as far as craft breweries in the state are. You know, other states have many more craft brewers than we do all along each coast. You know, pick a state, Washington, Oregon, California, they all have many, many more craft brewers than we do. So, Do I think we can get that back? You bet. I'm pretty proud of our state. I think that people in this state have great educations, and they're parochial in their buying habits, and they pay attention to where their food comes from. And I think that we're just at the forefront, really, of a real exciting time to be a small brewer in this state.
What do you think the craft beer industry can learn from, say, the way Wisconsin cheese is marketed?
Well, that's kind of an interesting thing because having been here forever now, Specialty Cheese Association had come years ago to talk to me about how I was marketing. And so I think we're, you know, actually a little bit ahead of the curve, you know, and now we can trade information back and forth. But what I think overall is that people really are hungry for information, and they love to know the story of where their food comes from. It's an easy conversation. It's nice to know that your money is staying in the state. You know, we pay a lot in taxes, but we also employ lots of people, and we're good revenue creators in our areas. You know, all of us, when you give a tour or, you know, somebody comes by to see the brewery, then they head into town to go have dinner or stay at the hotel, or they need their car fixed or buy a house here. You know, so I think that people understand that, and craft brewers and cheesemakers will always be great partners.
Now, I read that Wisconsin is something like 10th or 11th in the production of craft beer nationwide. If there were a Wisconsin Beer Commission, do you think that would help propel Wisconsin further up the list?
Well, I think it would, because if it could level the playing field with all of our regulatory issues, and that would be a nice thing. And also, if there were just you know, focus on the tourism, or even some simple things like road signs that say, you know, this way to Minhas or Capital Brewery, that would be a great thing.
And you talked a little bit about some of the challenges that craft breweries face, but in particular, what do you think is outstanding that really needs to be addressed to move the industry?
Well, it's very hard for a craft brewer to start, and one of the big things is trying to get their feet under them in regards to distribution. And at this particular juncture, small brewers are really at a disadvantage. And, you know, that has been done with some thought and effort from other teams. And, you know, I'm hopeful that that might turn around. One thing that I've been very vocally upset about was when I started the brewery, and up until a couple years ago, brewers were always required to have a wholesaler license. And if things went, you know, very badly somewhere, at least I would be able to deliver my own beer. Now I'm looking at $32 million of bricks and mortar investment in the state. And the fact is that if all of a sudden I was without a wholesaler, you know, I don't know how I would get the beer to the market. I wouldn't be able to do it except for a short period of time on my own.
What is the top thing that you want the people of Wisconsin to know about why craft beer matters in Wisconsin?
Well, I think craft beer matters for a whole number of reasons. For one, if you're ignoring craft beer, you are missing out on, you know, a rainbow of flavor that really should not be missed. It is one of the most economical ways to enjoy flavor. It, you know, beer can be sour or bitter or, you know, really malty or sweet. We age it in bourbon barrels. We add fruit. There's light beers and dark beers and beers made with wheat and caramely beers and, you know, everything under the sun. And so it's really fun to pair with food and cheese, and you're missing out on a very obtainable richness if you ignore craft beer. But in addition to that, why it's good for the state is, like I said, our job creation, the enormous amount of taxes that we pay, you know, because we pay our regular payroll and property tax like everybody else, but we also have an extra special surcharge for the privilege of making beer. But also, I just think that it's nice to know where your food comes from. And when you get around and start to meet brewers and see their story and see how complicated the process of making beer is, it gives everybody a newfound respect. And I think that's something that the big brewers kind of took away from Americans in general. They've spent a lot of time promoting beer as kind of a commodity or vehicle to meet girls who pop out of sand dunes. But in fact, it's a food product with a rich heritage.
Deborah, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you, Victoria. Appreciate the call.
We've been talking to Deborah Carey, founder and president of New Glarus Brewing Company. Wisconsin State Representative Gary Talke would like to create a Wisconsin Beer Commission to promote the state's breweries.
A new issue of Discover Magazine hits newsstands tomorrow. One of the editors is with us now to give a preview of some of the top stories in this month's issue.
Our guest is Gemma Tarlak. She's a senior associate editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. Gemma, welcome back.
Hi, great to be with you guys again.
So a lot of cool stuff in this issue that we have to discuss today. One cool thing coming up has to do with a new way to discover lost cities, LIDAR. Am I pronouncing that right?
Yeah, actually. And, you know, I love that word because it makes me think of something Dr. Evil would have, you know, sharks that shoot LIDAR. But it's short for light detection and ranging, and it is a laser scanning technology. That it's been used a little bit in Mesoamerica, but for the first time, they used it at Angkor, the site in Cambodia that we all recognize from National Geographic and Angelina Jolie movies. It's that fantastic temple complex, and they had a helicopter just pass over the site back and forth for hours and hours and hours, and it shot out these little laser pulses. It shot out 200,000 of them per second. And when I read that statistic, my head just kind of exploded. But so it shot these laser pulses down into the dense jungle, and the pulses were able to penetrate the vegetation and actually give them the most accurate, detailed topography of what's beneath all the vegetation. And they found the size of the city and the organization, the complexity, is far greater than they thought. Just an easy statistic to bring it home. It's got a suburban area three times the size of Atlanta.
Wow.
I mean, if you've ever been stuck on a freeway in Atlanta, you know that's pretty impressive. And this is all back in the 12th century. It's pretty amazing.
And right now, or up till now, it was as if, you know, you had a picture of Madison in the future. All you had was the state capitol and the Capitol Square, and that's all you knew about the town. That's kind of the exponential scale this expands our understanding, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And they really have a much better appreciation for the degree of organization. I mean, they had planning to avoid flooding the homes. They had these special ponds built in the same alignment that they could tell this was planned. This wasn't just you know, a guy in the backyard saying, hey, my neighbor's house never gets flooded. I'll do what he's doing. So they really show just the incredible amount of organization that was, you know, part of this capital city of the lost Khmer Empire.
What do the images coming back look like after these laser pulses are sent down?
Well, they do a variety of different treatments of the data that comes back in, and some of them are these gorgeous, multicolored, kind of three-dimensional maps. Others are just sort of black and white, very stark, almost schematic-looking. But they can manipulate the data that comes in all different ways. They can separate, say, modern roads from evidence of medieval roads and just give it all different kinds of treatment to develop a better understanding, not only of what was there, but when it was built. They're actually able to tell from the laser scanning technology kind of the rough chronology of when things appeared.
This really changes my image of how archaeology will be done, from the cinematic version of Lara Croft or Indiana Jones hacking their way through the jungle with machetes and swinging over traps, or the real way, which is probably grad students with machetes painstakingly dusting off pottery shards. And this really changes archaeology, doesn't it?
You know, it does, and I have a few friends who are archaeologists, and none of them own fedoras, but they're all field people, you know, and I can see this really kind of revolutionizing their field, but in a good way. Mm-hmm. You know, I think there will always be the option to, you know, put on the khaki shorts and the hiking boots and go out into the jungle, but now when you're going out into the jungle, you have such a better roadmap. I mean, before, really, the only way to determine the contours of the city, the lost city, was to kind of go out there with the machete. Now you can have your data points. You can, you know, reference that on that battery-powered tablet you've got in your hand, and boom, you're probably able to get much more research done in a single field season, much more accurate, too, than ever before.
But they're not done once they take those LIDAR images. Then they can go to the ground and know exactly where to start digging.
Exactly.
Well, let's move on to one of the other features in this month's magazine, this one about Matt Lewin, an expedition physician. First of all, let's talk about what exactly is an expedition physician.
Well, speaking of fedoras,
he's got a real one.
Yeah, right. Well, actually, I have to say he's kind of my hero. He's had an amazing career. He started out kind of as an amateur paleontologist, but decided he wanted to be this doctor who had exotic adventures, and he made it happen. He went to medical school, got a PhD, also practiced in an emergency room for a while, decided it wasn't for him. And I have to say the writer, Eric Vance, did an amazing job kind of conveying the emotional battle that Matt Lewin experienced when he decided ER medicine wasn't for him. But he got involved in basically expedition medicine. Doctors in very remote places, they don't have access to most of the tools that doctors in Milwaukee or Madison would have. And so they've got to deal with emergencies, whether it's an outbreak of an unknown illness, someone getting their leg crushed by a fossil falling on it, that was something Matt had to deal with, or even someone choking. You know, one of the most vivid images in the story to me was a new use for a safety pin. With a choking victim, you can pin their tongue to their cheek with a safety pin to keep them from choking.
Wow.
Yeah.
You think you want to be a doctor to try that?
Yeah, wow. Let's all think about that mental image for a while.
Well, it changed the way, again, we think about how science is done. Because when I think of science work, an image of a lab pops into my head. But
right.
There are people out in really remote places around the world doing primatology, geology, astronomy, you name it, far from a hospital.
Right. And not only that, but a lot of the folks on these expeditions, you know, they're dealing with jackhammers. They're dealing with heavy equipment. They've got to move fossils that maybe, you know, they may weigh hundreds of pounds. And again, if you drop it, if you're in a mudslide situation, say, some of these jungle situations are you know, not exactly safe to begin with, you can be bitten by any number of things or contract any number of diseases. So it's really incredible what they do, what these expedition doctors do with the barest of essentials.
And it's kind of fascinating to see what he puts in his must-have survival kit. It's not all stuff I would think you would want. You mentioned the safety pins, but you know, he always brings sugar along with him for another.
Yeah, that one fascinated me. He brings it along just because, you know, you can't be sure that a diabetic, say, is going to remember to bring a source of sugar, you know, to help them. And he also cleans wounds with it. I mean,
really?
He also talks about using honey as a dressing, which actually they did that in antiquity. I know the Roman army used honey as a wound dressing, but he's experimenting with ways of making it even more efficacious.
So one more story we have to talk about today, a new documentary about the finding of the Higgs boson particle, a particle fever. What did you learn about the successful search ultimately for the Higgs boson?
Well, I was able to talk to David Kaplan, who is a physicist and also the producer and kind of the brainchild of this movie. And, you know, he said it best. He was in the middle of all the preparation for the opening of the Large Hadron Collider outside Geneva, and he realized we are making history here. So he, at first, took his camera and started filming all these little moments and incidents during the build-up to the opening of the facility. Then he realized he wasn't such a great filmmaker, so he got a professional team to do the filming and the editing and everything. Really some stellar, got some Oscar winners on board in the crew. And they captured, you know, we all know the science, the Higgs boson, why it's important, why, you know, how it was discovered, what it means, et cetera. But they really captured the human side of what's going on. You know, I think a lot of times we hear about these huge scientific discoveries, and it's just science, you know, it's a bunch of numbers, it's a bunch of data. We don't think about the guy who comes home at night to his family and is tucking his kids into bed, and this really puts a human face on it. I mean, they fight, they argue, they, you know, they have hopes and dreams, and it's wonderful. It follows about half dozen physicists from all different disciplines within the field, all different ages, all different stages of their career, and it follows them through the buildup to firing up the Large Hadron Collider, and then actually finding the Higgs boson, confirming the data. And you really feel like you're there and see just a really fascinating side that I think a lot of times you don't see when we're talking about particle physics.
And, Jem, in our last 20 seconds here, there's still a lot we don't know about the Higgs, right?
That's right, yeah. And that kind of ends on a cliffhanger, all these tantalizing possibilities, but maybe that'll be in the sequel.
Well, we can watch for that. Gemma, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
That was Gemma Tarlak, Senior Associate Editor at Discover Magazine. They're based in Waukesha. She joins us each month to bring us some of the coolest stories from the world of science. The standoff between Ukraine and Russia continues. The Crimean region is on a path to break away from Ukraine. Their parliament voted to do that, and a referendum is scheduled for this weekend. But neither Ukraine nor much of the Western world recognize that referendum as legitimate.
The United States is taking steps towards sanctions against Russia and against wealthy Russians affiliated with the government. But there are questions about how effective those efforts would be and whether Western Europe would cooperate.
William Pomeranz joins us now. He's deputy director of the Kennan Institute at the Woodrow Wilson Center. Will, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here.
So just 6 days now, by my count, until that scheduled referendum in Crimea. Is this something that anyone in the world, maybe outside of Russia, is viewing as a legitimate election?
No. And in fact, there's been deafening silence in terms of any other country supporting Russia that these results would be legitimate. It doesn't appear that the world is going to be able to stop the referendum. Russia has voiced its desire to proceed. We'll have to just wait and see what happens after the referendum in terms of its consequences for Russia and the region.
And there's been some difficulty even trying to get international attention to that referendum. A UN envoy chased around by a crowd, difficulties for reporters in the region. Is there any question that this is going to go anyway but a Crimean vote to join Russia?
No, I think that is pretty much an assured result that the vote will go for joining the Russian Federation.
And if that happens, Russia then says, yeah, okay, you're on. Is there anything Ukraine can do realistically about it?
Well, we still have to wait and see whether Russia does, in fact, have the Crimea join the Russian Federation. Mm-hmm. And there's questions for Russia in terms of its willingness to recognize different republics and different regions and granting them sort of the right to self-determination. That sort of recognition will have consequences within the Russian Federation. So if there's any hesitation, it will be because of domestic reasons. But as of right now, there's every reason to suggest that Russia would welcome Crimea into the Russian Federation. And no, there is nothing that Ukraine can do to protest, to stop this, other than to protest the development and insist that this is in violation of international law.
So you were saying that maybe Russia might hold back because they say if we recognize the Crimea's right to leave Ukraine, it might give legitimacy to, say, Chechen separatists under Russia.
One would have thought that would be their reasoning. And for, you know, the better part of two decades, that has been Russia's reasoning. Russia is a great believer in notions of national sovereignty. It hasn't recognized the rights of people to exercise self-determination. And I should emphasize that it's unlikely that Russia would hesitate at this point not to include Crimea into the Russia Federation after it has staked so much on this vote. But what I'm really trying to suggest is that when it does welcome Crimea into Russia and it recognizes the right of self-determination, that is something that will have consequences potentially inside Russia.
Let's turn to the Ukraine side of this now. The Ukrainian government is new, just after ousting the old government, unstable. Is this situation rallying Ukrainians around this fledgling government?
I think that there is an argument to be made that yes, that Ukraine has never been as united as it is today in light of the potential threat that Russia poses to Ukraine's national sovereignty. There are various vulnerable regions in Ukraine, in the east, and in Odessa, where there are a lot of Russian speakers. I should add that many Russian speakers can be and are Ukrainian nationalists themselves, so one shouldn't assume that just because they speak Russian that they're necessarily pro-Russian or pro-Russian Federation in this particular instance. But yes, the actions of Russia, I think, have united the people of Ukraine around this government, although there have been protests. And the crucial issue is that this government, as an interim government, has to get to presidential elections as soon as possible, so the question of legitimacy is put behind them.
Let's dig a little deeper into Putin's motivations here. He has said many times that he regrets the breakup of the former Soviet Union into a bunch of separate countries. Is he thinking maybe in the long term of trying to rebuild it a little bit here, a little bit there?
Well, I don't know if he's really thinking of rebuilding the entire Soviet Union. What I think happened is that the possibility of losing Ukraine from the Eurasian bloc was just simply too much for Putin, and therefore he felt compelled to act in light of his own worldview. Ukraine posed various challenges to Russia. It was about to sign this EU association agreement that would have created a free trade zone between Ukraine and the EU, and that would have posed various sorts of economic threats on Russia. But it also, the association agreement also posed, as it were, an existential threat to Russia, that it couldn't imagine that it would lose Ukraine from its general sphere of influence,
That's a phrase I wanted to bring up, is sphere of influence. This isn't necessarily a desire in the long game for Russia to bring more pieces back under Russian direct control, but they view this as their playground, their economic zone too.
Well, they do, and they've been trying to convince Ukraine to join this so-called customs union, which is leading to a broader Eurasian union. But Ukraine has hesitated, and Ukraine has hesitated because such a closer relationship with Russia would hurt its ability to pursue European markets. So they're trying to make their own cost-benefit analysis as to where to go and to what economic relationships to pursue. Ideally, Ukraine would want to pursue both. It's in its interest to have good relations with Russia, to have extensive trade with Russia, but it's also in its interest to increase its trade with the EU. And what has occurred here is simply it has Ukraine's kind of realistic decision has been now overwhelmed by Russia's zero-sum game analysis.
Putting this in context, is there anything we can learn from the Russian military intervention in Georgia back in, I think it was 2008?
Well, I think the Russian military has improved over the last 5 to 6 years. There's been a lot of investment in it. The performance of the Russian military during the Georgian War by experts has been judged as not a great effort, but it was enough to kind of restore order as it had existed previously. The question really is, can the Russian military engage in major operations in Ukraine? We don't know the answer to that. We do know that if they were to do so, they would be met by serious opposition from the Ukrainian military. Now, the Ukrainian army is smaller than the Russian army. It's probably less well-trained, but there is no doubt that Ukraine would put up a very strong resistance to any move by the Russian military inside the country, outside of Crimea. Crimea becomes a different case by itself, but any further incursion into Ukraine.
There are a number of small countries probably watching this very closely. I'm thinking of former Soviet states like Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia. Are they watching this thinking, gosh, could we be next?
I think they're watching it very carefully. All three of those Baltic states are now a member of NATO, and the NATO guarantees of security would immediately come into play if there was any attack against the Baltic states. So I think they're watching these events with great concern. There are various sorts of stories coming out of potential threats from Russia to the Baltic states again. But these states have joined NATO. They are members of the EU. So the costs for Russia are much higher in this particular instance than would be Ukraine, which is not a member of NATO.
We're breaking down the latest news from Russia and Ukraine with William Pomeranz of the Woodrow Wilson Center.
We're continuing our conversation about Russia and Ukraine with William Pomeranz of the Woodrow Wilson Center as Crimea approaches a weekend referendum on leaving Ukraine and joining Russia.
You can join in with your questions and your thoughts at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org. Well, I wanted to touch on what, if anything, the United States can do here. We're hearing from the president sanctions. They're working towards some kind of sanctions, possibly targeting not the country as a whole, but individuals, wealthy individuals connected with Putin. Do we have a lot of leverage there, though?
Well, we can introduce sanctions that target individuals, and it's been very interesting because the loudest cries from Russia have been over the possibility of introducing sanctions against individuals around Putin. So clearly they want to, these individuals want to still have access to their money. They still want to be able to go to the West and visit their money. So clearly sanctions do have an impact, and that is what is producing the largest cries from Russia. But there is a question as to whether targeted sanctions can really reverse what has happened in Crimea. That seems to be much less likely, and it will be very difficult to get the EU and the United States to agree on harsher sanctions, I think.
Yeah, the EU is more economically interconnected with Russia than we are. In part, some of the countries there, I think, rely on Russia for natural gas. Winter's not quite over yet. How much of a factor is that in Western Europe's thinking?
Well, I think it's a real factor. And yes, Western Europe and parts of the of Eastern Europe get significant amounts of their energy from Russia, and therefore they simply are not in a position to cut off relations with Russia in response to the actions in Crimea. That being the case, various threats from Russia will encourage these countries, I think, to go seek out other sources of that energy. Russia is a bit heavy-handed in how it deals with its customers, especially when it threatens to cut off supplies. And that, since this is a market, as best they can, I think countries in Europe will now begin to seek out other sources of energy as best they can.
We'll go to our callers now. We've got Joe on the line in Prairie du Chien. Joe, hi.
Hi. My question is, when are the next presidential elections in Russia, and how is Putin's policies, or how are Putin's policies playing out with the Russian electorate?
Well, Mr. Putin does not face the electorate again until 2018. He was elected in 2012 to a six-year term. That is a result of a reform of the Constitution. It used to be that they were elected to four-year terms, but that was expanded to 6 years. So he has a long time before he has to face the electorate. Not surprisingly, the Russian electorate has rallied around Putin during this crisis, and there isn't really a strong opposition that one could really imagine that could dislodge Mr. Putin in the short term. The real issue is to what extent these actions have economic consequences in Russia. The Russian economy has been faltering. It's on the edge of recession. And if there is a real economic downturn, that will be a real test of Putin's system. And so far, Putin has enjoyed the fact that he has increased the standard of living. We'll have to see what happens if he now finds himself fighting inflation and a decrease in standard of living, and what sort of electoral consequences that would have.
And how vulnerable is Russia's economy to the kind of instability the occupation or annexation of the Crimea might involve?
Well, that's a very interesting point, because Russia is much more integrated into the world economy today than the Soviet Union ever was. So clearly Russia will feel various sorts of economic pressures as a result of their actions. One of the big problems for Russia is really a disastrous level of capital flight. Last year, more than $60 billion left the country. It's been reported that upwards of $20 billion left the country in January alone of this year. This is the money that Russia desperately needs to revive its economy, to diversify its economy, and to grow. So if the response to what Putin has done in Crimea is to increase the level of capital flight, then the Russian economy will suffer. And that would also put more pressure on Putin in the medium and long term.
Is that capital flight foreign investors saying, maybe we don't want to invest in Russia? Or is that wealthy Russians trying to shield their money outside of the country?
It's primarily the latter. It's Russians trying to get their money out in various ways. I think foreign investors, over the last year, there has obviously been a decline in all the emerging markets, and Russia is no exception. But I think in light of what has occurred, I think Western investors will yet again rethink their strategies in Russia. One of the interesting responses of the Duma to this whole crisis was to threaten the confiscation of the property of Western investors if sanctions were imposed. Western investors don't like risk. They don't like to hear the word confiscation. And as a result, that could also have a negative impact on foreign investment in Russia.
We'll go back to our callers now. Ben is with us in Green Bay. Ben, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I think it's really interesting what the Western NATO will do when, you know, Crimea inevitably, I think, obviously, it seems like they will approve the referendum to join, you know, Russia this this weekend. It seems like they're very tied into Russia. They seem very favorable to passing that referendum. So what happens when, you know, the does Russia then just automatically decide that they want to annex Crimea? You know, it's really interesting to see what's going to happen and find out. I'd like to make a recommendation about a news source that I've been really following. It's called Vice, V-I-C-E. They've been doing some really refreshing on-the-ground eyewitness reporting from Crimea. So thanks.
Ben, thanks for the call. So, yeah, what can the international community do that we're not doing, that they're not doing now, if, in fact, Crimea becomes part of the Russian Federation?
Well, I don't see what the West can do militarily. Ukraine is not a member of NATO. This is occurring in Russia's backyard. Russia has already has the troops on the ground. It already has bases in Crimea. There is very little, I think, that one can expect the U.S. to do militarily in response to what is going on in Crimea. I think it will depend on what we talked about earlier on sanctions and the market and whether the market begins to elect not to invest in Russia.
I kind of want to ask a couple questions about intentions here. Was there a plan on the shelf, do we think, that Putin had saying, if such and such happens, we'd like to end up with Crimea? Or is this just an ad hoc improvised response to what happened in Ukraine that led them kind of one step at a time to this situation we're in now?
Well, it's obviously difficult to know, but in reading the various press reports, and there was an excellent article on this by Steve Myers in the New York Times, where he argues and shows that this really was much more of an ad hoc decision, that Putin thought that the agreement on February 21st, when President Yanukovych would remain in power and oversee a transition, he thought that was going to hold. It didn't last 24 hours, and after that, he felt compelled to move. It also has an ad hoc feel because Putin let the crisis go on for so long, and that was largely because of the Olympics. All this occurred in the run-up to the Olympics and during the Olympic Games, and obviously he couldn't engage in these heavy-handed tactics as long as the world had come to Sochi to participate in the Olympic Games. So I think this has more of a feel of an ad hoc decision. In his article, Steve Myers says that essentially that he got together with five or six of his fellow security officers and made this decision. And that seems to make sense because he clearly did not have an economist in the room. And I don't think he really had anyone from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs because they've all been trying to backtrack and try to justify something that is very difficult and something that in the past Russia has not supported.
You can go back to the phones. You've got Esty with us in Madison. Hi, Esty.
Hi. I want to ask your guest about the role of the extreme right in the resistance in Ukraine, the Svoboda Party, and its Nazi-wearing uniform members, and the fact that they have a fairly significant number of members in the Ukrainian Congress, and they have several important ministers. I read a letter from the president of the World Jewish Congress to the Patriarch of the Ukrainian Church talking about young Ukrainians wearing the dreaded SS uniforms with swastika clearly visible in their helmets.
Esty, I want to jump in and give Will a chance to respond. That's been an accusation from people around the world, including the Russians, that there is a strong nationalist, extreme nationalist element to the Ukrainian protests.
There is an extreme right in Ukraine, just as there is an extreme right in Russia and in several other of the neighboring republics. Yes, the Svoboda Party has been represented in the Supreme Rada, and there is a real concern about whether Ukrainian nationalism could overwhelm what is about to occur in Ukraine. There have been some very interesting polls leading up to the presidential election, and what's been revealing is, in fact, that the far right has polled very poorly. Svoboda and the private sector, which is another far-right group, I think got no more than 4 or 5% of the national electorate. So it doesn't look like, at least at the present time, that they're going to kind of ride their way to a presidential victory. But this is a very issue of great concern. As opposed to the question of anti-Semitism and so forth, in fact, several of the leaders of the current interim government are Jewish, and various prominent members of the Jewish community have written to Russia and to President Putin saying that there has not been an increase of anti-Semitism and that they feel quite comfortable living in Ukraine.
Historical view here. We're closing in on the 100th anniversary of the outbreak of World War I, where basically a bunch of world leaders bungled themselves into a manner of war that nobody expected or wanted. I don't know, maybe I'm being overdramatic here. How worried about are you about ad hoc improvised responses here leading to something much, much worse than we have today?
I think that is a very real concern. Obviously, any sort of incident, either in Crimea, in Donetsk, in Odessa, anyone who kind of takes the law into their own hand, the random shots and so forth, this could raise the level of tension dramatically. And that is why it is so important to try to find a diplomatic solution. How we address the issue of Crimea is going to be one that will test the international community for years to come. But we're not going to be able to stop this referendum that's taking place on Sunday. And we're probably not going to be able to stop Russia, if it wants to, somehow annex Crimea. But steps must be taken to defuse this crisis and not let it spread and not let some sort of wild shot anywhere in this region spark a larger conflict.
Will, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That was William Pomeranz, Deputy Director of the Kennan Institute at the Woodrow Wilson Center.